Honorable members, Mr. Director of National Prosecutions, Honorable Mr. Mishani, and colleagues, I thought that the honorable members would ask me to not be harsh so that I can go and process these people who are giving us problems. So I hope they won't blame me for not prosecuting those tenures. Yes. Are there any apologies? Okay, thank you. We'll note that. There's from our side, Honorable Mutapo and Honorable Majaki. They have been called to an urgent meeting in Johannesburg. And in fact, today we have a challenge that some people are connecting fights, and they have responsibilities in their provinces because of the situation facing the country. So we don't want to belabor any issue. We just want to deal with the crux of the matter that is presented between before us, so that we release everybody timelessly. I think without much ado, allowing Honorable Horn, Honorable Tumula sit down comfortably, we will ask Mr. Nusana to take us through the report.
Chair, once more, thank you once more for the opportunity to come and present our report. From our side, I have one apology from Advocate Chiba. She shouldn't be with us today. My team comprises of three deputies, that's Dr. Ramaite, Mr. Hofmeyr, and Advocate Mkhatla, the CEO, Advocate Van Rensburg, and the acting deputy CEO, Ms. Makeke, and I have also the acting chief financial officer, Mrs. Van Zey, and the gentleman also the Mr. Duma, who is acting as my advisor in my office. Thank you.
And thank you for being here.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think that the report was submitted timely and that the honorable members had the opportunity to go through the report. We'll just try to deal with the salient features of the report and then take questions where necessary. I'll just give the background and then I'll allow the respective deputies to deal with their sections, as well as the CEO and the acting financial officer. The background, starting with the background, that is the slide number three, the NBA has committed itself to playing its role in the realization of the goals set by the government through the National Development Plan, and the strategic plans aligned with the medium-term strategic framework, the MTSF. At NPA, we have five sub-programs in the ENA, that is the budget. The National Prosecution Services, the National Specialized Prosecution Services, Asset Forfeiture Unit, Office of for the Witness Protection, and Support Services. And the NPA has four strategic objectives, which are the following: the increased successful prosecution, improved prosecution of cases that require specialized prosecution, and also to ensure profit is removed from crime, and to ensure threatened witnesses and related persons are successfully prosecuted. Protected. Yes. Each objective is specifically linked to a sub-problem as reflected in the budget. Both the NDA strategy plan 2015 to 2020 and annual performance plan 2015-2016 were aligned to link the strategic objectives to the budget structure. Each of the deputational directors of public prosecutions is responsible for a sub-program for improved accountability. The NPA amended its 2014-2015 annual performance plan in October 2014 to align the revised MPSF, and there are no material changes in the 2015-2016 plan except for the following. The performance indicator, that is the performance of legal opinions provided to the National Director of Public Prosecutions within 20 days, has been removed from the annual performance plan. Some technical indicator descriptions were also refined for audit purposes. The Office of the Chief Justice has taken over responsibility for the performance of the High Courts in agreement with National Treasury. The following indicators were amended to reflect this position. The number of criminal court cases, including alternative dispute resolution mechanism finalized in the lower courts, the number of criminal court cases finalized with a verdict in the lower courts, and the number of criminal court cases finalized in the lower courts through ADRM. The NPA, however, changed conviction rates in the higher courts as a performance indicator. And targets were incrementally increased in line with previous increases, while the budget allocation increase was less than previous years. Other targets were not increased due to optimal performance, and these are conviction rates in the high courts, regional courts, organized crime, trio crimes, and complex commercial crimes. Chair, with your permission, I stage my hand over to Advocate Van Rensburg to deal with the NPA strategic plan.
Thank you, Chair. As regards presentation of the strategic plan, as you know, the strategic plan really just contains the very high-level strategic objectives and outcomes, but we'll start by the organizational structure, which there haven't been any changes to, with the exception of the acting position with the departure of Ambassador Sulu on retirement, with Ms. Makeke, his acting deputy CEO at the moment. Then the strategic overview, the outcome orientated goal for the NPA is improved prosecution service, and our role statement is to render a prosecution service that is effective. I think our purpose is well known and also contained within the estimate of national expenditure. As indicated by the National Director, each strategic objective has been linked to a Deputy National Director to improve accountability. And in our presentation, we also then indicate you the budget that's been allocated to each of these programs, as well as the staff allocation, just in terms of the litigators and then the administrative support. But this does not then include corporate services, the support services, which is the bulk of the support services for the organization. So as indicated by National Director, the first strategic objective is increased successful prosecution, which is national prosecution first. And this is Dr. Silas Ramahite, and this obviously is the core function of the organization, and this is where the bulk of the budget also is. Second one is improved prosecution of cases that require specialized prosecution, and this is the National Specialized Prosecution Service, and it is Advocate Mohatla, and that which you will then be presenting about those areas of responsibility. But that is SECU, PCLU, and SOCOM. And then ensure that the property is removed from crime, that's at the forfeit unit, Mr. Willie Hofmeyer, and ensure that threatened witnesses and related persons are successfully protected, is also Advocate Mohatla, which is the Official Witness Protection. So strategic objective one for the National Prosecution Service is increased successful prosecution, as I said, and the main indicator of the objective statement is to increase the number of criminal court cases finalized, including ADRM, in the lower courts. In the past, the lower courts, it was all courts. It was High Court included, but now with the Office of the Chief Justice Statement of Responsibility for accounting for that indicator, we've removed that from the performance information of the NDA. Based on information provided, and we also then indicate the links to the NPSF, which outlines the National Development Plan and the CDS 720 Plan. The second strategic objective then is National Specialized Prosecution Service, and these are the contributing commercial crime complex, commercial crime, and the number of operational Tutuzela care centers, differentiating between Tutuzela care centers where various services are delivered to those where all the services as per the blueprint are delivered, so that's an operational TCC. Then we do the baseline, the objective, and as I said, links as well. At its forfeiture, two main indicators there, the number and the value target, the number for the complete forfeiture cases, and the value of the seizing orders, the baseline, etc. Office witness protection, with the appropriate injured witnesses and related persons that have been included in recent times to the indicator because of to more clearly align it to the Witness Protection Act that requires us not only to protect witnesses but also related persons. So we want to ensure that none of those persons are harmed or sexually killed while on the witness protection program. Risk management, we've identified a number of risks at an enterprise level. We also do the risks at the various business unit level, but the main risk for our organization is public perception and reputation of the National Prosecuting Authority, breach of information security and minimum information security standards, provisioning of resources, participation and cooperation from stakeholders and other partners, and the ability to respond to trends in the commission of crime. All of these, there is an owner, which is the Deputy National Director or myself, and their mitigating plans are developed and the implementation thereof monitored. We then proceed to the annual performance plan or strategic objective one, and Dr. Ramaiti will do that presentation.
Thank you, Chair. Okay. Thank you, Chair. I think as the CEO has indicated, we are responsible for sub-program one of the NPA under the National Prosecution Service, and the main objective is increase successful prosecution. The annual targets are set up from page 19 of the presentation. There are basically 10 indicators or the performance indicators. The first performance indicator is the number of criminal court cases, including ADRM, finalized in the lower courts. We audited the actual performance there for 2014-2015. It set out the 472469 and the medium-term target. The target for 2015-2016 is 478686. The second performance indicator is the number of criminal court cases finalized with verdict in the lower courts. The audited or actual performance for 2014-2015 is 323265, and the target for 2015-2016 is 326498. And the third performance indicator is the number of criminal court cases finalized in the lower courts through ADRM. The audited or actual performance for 2014-2015 149204, and the target for 2015-2016 is 151888. The rest of the performance indicators are conviction rates, basically. So the fourth one will be conviction rates in the High Court. And the estimated performance for 2014-2015 is 87%. We have kept it at that for 2015-2016. The next one is conviction rate in the regional courts. The estimated performance for 2014-2015 is 74%. We have kept it as it is at 74%. And then conviction rate in the district courts, the estimated performance is 87%. We have increased it by a percentage point. And then conviction rates in organized crime, the estimated performance is 90%. We have kept it at 90%. And then the next one is conviction rates in sexual offenses. The estimated performance for 2014-2015 is 67%. We have increased it slightly to 68% for 2015-2016. And then conviction rates in trio crimes, the estimated performance is 85%, and we've kept it that. Although I need to mention that yesterday we had a meeting with directors of public prosecutions, and we raised concerns around whether in fact we will be able to achieve those targets. There are difficulties which we're looking into, but they mainly relate to poor investigations, because in these few crimes, you have robberies and so on. There shouldn't be any problems if there is evidence, but we are looking into that. So we hope that we will at least attempt to achieve the target. And then the last one is conviction rates in violent protests and industrial action prosecuted. We haven't been keeping statistics in the past, but we are now beginning to keep statistics, so we will have a baseline. But we have set a target of 74% conviction rate. I think that's it, Chairs.
As previously indicated, what we've done for easier reading for the portfolio committee and also in a strategic plan like that, we put the budget so that you can see what the resources are that this component is available for to be able to deliver on a strategic objective. And as you can see, the bulk of the money in the organization will be there, and obviously most of that within that component goes to the compensation of employees, bill, the salary, the wage bill. Mrs. Van Kaag will present in more detail relating to the actual breakdown, the percentage increase for each of the components over the financial years, and also discuss with you our ability to spend, as well as whether this will have any impact on the achievement of our targets. But I can say that we were mindful of the fact of the economic environment in which we are operating, so we have in the past 3 years been spending our money on items which have a long-term impact on the organization. So this year, although the money is very tight, we do not specifically will be short of funding. The money that we have will be used just for clean operational purposes. There's no specific projects and that which we're able to undertake in this financial year due to the financial situation. As you can see, it is a very, very small increase, say 6% in 15-16. There's a number of persons that are employed in that area. This is where the bulk of the people also are. So there's 3,564 legal people, which is then prosecuted in the lower court, regional court, the district court, regional court, and high courts. And the admin personnel, this will be at the director's offices and with the chief prosecutors and senior prosecutors, there's 551. So then strategic objective 2, advocate Mukhatla will then present strategic objective 2.
Thank you very much. I will then proceed and start with the conviction rate in complex commercial crimes. As we know that the NPP has already indicated that there are incremental changes to the targets, but in some instances we are at a point where we have seen ourselves as we optimally perform up to this level. So you will see that in the conviction rate in complex commercial crimes, we have not increased the targets. It sits at 93% throughout up to 2018. The number of operational TCCs, when we reported last year, we mentioned that we have 38 that are operational, but we provide services at a number of 55 centers. And we had estimated that we would perform to a level of having 50 operational TCC centers by the end of the last financial year, and we're looking 2015-16 to have all 55 being fully operational TCC centers, and in the next 5 years we're looking to increase that to with 20 to be 75 in 2018-2019. Going to the output 3, the number of persons convicted of corruption or offences related to corruption, where the amount benefited per case is more than 5 million. This is a cumulative target. We envisage to meet targets of 20 by to 2015-16, which will give a number of 40. And let me mention that in 2014-15, we have estimated that we will perform at 20 persons convicted. We have exceeded that target. And you will see in following years, it's incremental, 20, the next year 30, the next year 30 to meet the target of 100. The number of government officials convicted for corruption or offences related to corruption. The previous indicator was relating to the JPPS officials only. Now it's in relation to all the government officials, and the target has been increased to 1,000. It is also incremental like the previous one, and you will see that the number is increasing I beg your pardon, you will see that the estimated performance for 2014-15 was stated at 180. We have convicted 712, and the following years are also incremental to meet the 1,000 by 2017-18. The conviction rate of cybercrime prosecutions, we also have kept the target at 74% because we have reviewed ourselves and we have seen that we can only perform up to that level. Going to page 39, the percentage of cases reported at GCC centers, that is referred for court, to court for prosecutions, you will see that the target has increased to 51%, and we're only increasing it by 1% in the 2017-2018 financial year. The conviction rate in the PCLU, it used to sit at 100%, and now we have put it at 80% because we see that We had it at 100%, and now we are sitting at 80%, and we see that it is most unlikely that we will finalize all cases within the financial year, just to keep the 20% open for those purposes. I will also leave the financial part and the number of personnel to Mrs. Panzane when she does her presentation.
Thank you. May I then hand over to Ms. Osmeyer to deal with strategic objectives 3, asset forfeiture need.
Thank you, Chair. You will see that generally a number of the targets of the AFU have been increased quite significantly over the period, and I'll explain a little bit when dealing with each of these. In the number of completed forfeiture cases, you can see that our targets over the next few years go up by nearly 50% from where we were at 300 a few years ago. And that has largely been a result of a very good initiative with DPT in the Western Cape province, where we have really managed to roll out quite a lot of smaller forfeiture cases working with prosecutors in the magistrates' courts. We're doing about 100 of those at the moment. The rest of the increase is due to some increased productivity on our side, but also the greater use of Chapter 6, the non-conviction-based forfeiture, where we're not dependent on the preparation of the criminal trial. On the value targets, you will see generally that we are an even bigger increase over the period. 3 years ago, we were on about half a billion rand per year. We project to grow that to 1.2 billion rand by the end of the period. So from where we are at the moment, it's 117% increase in our targets. This is largely to do with a bigger focus by government on corruption cases and the very good cooperation that they have developed at the anti-corruption task team, where we work quite closely with the Hawks and the SIU. And the better and faster investigation of really big cases, they have really made a difference. We have agonized a bit about these big increases in our profits, but our performance this year and last year has been really good, and we do think that this is sustainable into the future. So we have gone for some quite ambitious targets. The number of freezing orders, there is not that much growth in the target over the period. You will see that our performance did slump a little bit 2 years ago due to capacity constraints. Last year we had a very good year where we achieved 360. So our targets for the future is still a little bit conservative. We were worried whether we could repeat last year's performance, and this year have been less good. But certainly there is some room for increasing our targets further there in the future. On the value of completed cases, as is the case with the other value targets, you can see that our target goes up from 180 in the current year to 260. That's an increase of about 35%, if my maths is correct. So again, we are increasing our targets quite substantially because of the work that is done in the anti-corruption task team. Similarly, with the value of freezing orders in the corruption cases, and I think that's where you can see a lot of the growth. 3 years ago, we were on 144 million rand. Our target for the end of the period is 1 billion rand. In fact, we did more than 1 billion rand this year. So, as our members can see, we are really making some impact through the work at the ACCC. The recoveries from government officials covers two things that we have counted traditionally. It is both where we recover money for government as the victim of a specific crime, so we recover money from an official and pay it back to government, or in some cases the money also gets paid into CARC, where it is department may not have been that directly a victim. But we count both of those as money that we've recovered from officials in corruption-related cases. Again, our targets go up quite ambitiously over the period. Here, our performance has been significantly better, and these targets were set at a time when we didn't really have baseline data for the past year. So, again, there is room for these targets to be significantly increased in the future. The next indicator I just wanted to say the same about, you will may recall that in the past we've essentially, I've counted payments into CARA or payments to victims as our indicators for how much money we actually recover. After some discussion, we have now decided to combine those two figures because both, if you put the two figures together, that's essentially how much money we have recovered in cash or property at the end of our case. So that is a new indicator. At the moment, we have just put in double the amount that we had previously for victim payments. So again, there is significant growth in that indicator, but there is probably room for a lot more growth as some of the big corruption cases are now reaching finality. In terms of our success rate, we don't foresee at the moment increasing that target. We're leaving it at 93%, but for pretty much the same reasons as with the NPA. Then another new indicator that is in government's medium-term strategic framework as well is the recoveries that we achieve from government officials. Then you will see that our target over the next few years double from 30 million to 60 million. There is, again, room for those targets to be increased in the future, I think, just from our experience in this year when we had this indicator for the first time. Sure, in terms of our budget, as with the rest of government, there's been little real increase in budgets. It's money inflation increases that we have over the next few years. So I think that is a challenge for us, just in the sense that especially with the work at ACCT, we are finding a lot more work to be done. And for the first time in many years, we actually have to start turning down work because of capacity issues. If we could just go to the next slide. Just on the personnel, I should just clarify under the legal personnel, I think that was just a template, but you have two classes of professional personnel. We have about, I think, 82 lawyers and about 26 financial investigators who work with the lawyers. The work of the financial investigators is essentially to find the assets where they have been hidden, because us criminals these days look pretty poor if you look at them, but the money is in all sorts of other entities. But also in our cases, it is important that we need to be able to prove the money flow, that we need to link those assets to the abused. And so the role of the financial investigators is essentially to do that asset tracing, but also what we call financial profiling, trying to show that people are spending more money than they earn and then saying, where does that money come from? Thank you, Chair.
Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. I'll go back to Advocate Mokgatla. Take us through the strategic objective 4.
For the witness protection offices, there are two performance indicators. The first one is that of the number of witness and related persons harmed, threatened or killed whilst on the witness protection program. The target there is zero. We wouldn't want to have anybody harmed during the program, and it stays at zero, and it has been kept that way for the last 12 years. The second indicator is the percentage of witnesses and related persons that walked off the witness protection program. 2013-14, we're sitting at the number of 12 people, witnesses and related people that have walked off. In 2014-15, we're sitting at 1.5%, and we intend to keep it at that minimal 1.5%. I'm going to jump now and go to slide number 46. The number of personnel in the witness protection office is 109, and the support staff is 49. And I'm specifically going to concentrate on the 109 who are doing the core business, and we're talking there of the protectors and some social workers. Our model is aimed to be a 24/7 model where we have protectors available throughout the day for the witnesses. And we are really understaffed in that regard. I am not at the moment asking for more money, but that is an area where more money will need to be channeled in order for us to have more core business personnel in order to be able to keep that target of zero. And we've seen that crime is increasing in the country, and it is rearing its head in different places, and we need to be available at an instance, and it's very difficult to be moving people from one province to another. And that's an area where I think that the CEO will be coming back and asking for more resources and more money. Thank you very much.
You are instigating the CEO again.
Thank you, Chair. I will then hand over to Ms. Van Zee to deal with the budget.
Thank you, Chair. The first slide is the NPA, as I think all are aware, we are a program of the Department of Justice. We're not a separate entity or constitutional institute. We are part of the Department of Justice. We have compiled separate financial statements as at the end of last year. As from the new financial year, we are consolidating our financial statements with that of the Department of Justice. So we will only be reflected as Program 4 in the Department of Justice financial statements. Our annual report as a whole will also be consolidated as in that of the Department of Justice, although the NPA will comply a separate report for the NDPP in terms of Section 35 of the NPA Act. Our capacity as the NPA to spend our budget, on the next slide you'll see our capacity, and we've been very successful in this area. We've managed to only surrender a few things in the last couple of years. The past year, we closed our financial system last year, and we're only surrendering 25 things again this year. So we're demonstrating a very good capacity to spend our budget. The next slide is the details of our spending. This is a pre-read report. That shows that we have spent full 100% of our budget allocations. Although we've spent the full 100%, we will do violence and shifting of funds between the various economic situations within the overall budget allocation. Our audit outcomes also were successful over the past few years. We've managed a clean audit. And the last year, we also drastically reduced our householding keeping findings. For the new financial year, we will only receive one audit report with that of the Department of Justice due to the consolidating of the reports. Our NCF budget allocation, The first slide is an indication of the MPAS program for in the Department of Justice. Here you can see we are the second largest program within that of the Department of Justice. Our budget growth is an average of 6% over the next MPF period. The next slide is also highlighted the percentage. Next year is a very low percentage increase, with only 2.68. This is due to National Treasury cut that was introduced a few years ago. This is basically going to have an impact on our business services, but as our CEO already indicated, we did some planning in this area, and we anticipate that we will manage our budget for the coming year, and we will be able to achieve all our strategic objectives. The next slide is the breakdown of our budget allocation between the various economic classifications. Here you will see the bulk of our budget is allocated to our compensation of employees, which accounts for about 83% of our budget. Our personnel, the other big spending item is on our goods and services, where you will see there's the increase, the National Treasury decrease, The current year we had 513 million, and that decreased to 484 million, and that's the one that we will manage in the coming years. The next slide is only the percentage increase per economic classification, and then the next slide we just indicated graph for you that shows the personnel increase versus our goods and services increase. So our goods and services remain stable, very low, but the personnel goes up. And this might create problems in outer years. The next one is also just our percentage of the goods and services that I've already spoke about. This personnel comprise of 83% of our budget, and the goods and services is 14%. The next slide is also just a graph to demonstrate the bulk of our budget is allocated to goods and to compensation. The next slide is alternative funding, which we do receive from CORA. We did submit a new bid of 45 billion during March 2013 for additional funding from CORA. We haven't received any feedback in this regard. We're still awaiting this. And then linked to this, we're also going to do a separate submission to the CORA fund for additional funding for witness protection to assist with ICP team members, witnesses. The CORA funds that we've received over the couple of years, we've also shown a good ability to spend our budget. Over the last years, there's a breakdown of the various projects that we did receive funding for and the amount that's left at the end of December. As at the end of March, we've basically spent all the CORA funds for the curator funds. We've got around 2 million left. We're on this slide, it indicates about 8 million left, so we spent more funding on that. The next slide is our IJS funding that we've received during the 2013-14 financial year. We did use this funding for the integrated case management project, the departmental BI and MI project, the departmental integration solution, the infrastructure and the capacity. With IJS funding, we're also one of the departments that did manage to spend our full budget allocation. We spend 100% of our allocation. Over the coming years, we're also going to receive more funding from IJS. On the next slide, you will see that in the coming year, we're going to receive 86 million and the outer year, 73 million. In this regard, we've also got really our project plans in place, and we anticipate that we will spend that money in full. Okay, that's the end of the budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And she will take us through the electronic case management system.
Thank you. The last few slides just deal with some of the key resourcing issues within the organization. The electronic case management system is a very important initiative that will, it's an integrated system throughout the value chain that will allow you to trace a case from the time at which it is registered at the police. It gets captured at the police station. It will enable us then, and the two sites are fully operational, and we're testing it at 22 sites some of this is available to us. But what happens is at the police station, they capture the case docked information. That information is then immediately available to us at our reception courts. We are able to then see the particulars of the accused, the particulars of the charge, and all that information, and generate a charge sheet to J15, as well as all the various types of crimes that we've developed the charge sheets for are then available to the prosecutor electronically. You can just use the dates provided to the petition of the crime and populate your charge sheet and print it. It also allocates a case number to that case. From there, go to the court. In the court, the DOJ then takes over, and the progress in that case, this person gets bail, there is on warning, etc., gets recorded then. From there, that information is then available to the Department of Correctional Services, where they can also then able to do demand management, because they can see which sort of criminals or future inmates are anticipated to be coming into the system, and it will enable us to trace a person throughout the system. At the moment, it's very difficult, and because all the data is captured relating to race, gender, age, etc., and nationality, we'll be able to answer a lot of the questions we often get asked. We don't keep that information about foreign nationals or etc., that we could ask what sort of crimes people are charged with and what the outcomes they are. So really, it also has got a business intelligence component that will enable us to generate very extensive and comprehensive management reports relating to performance, direct lead times of certain processes within the criminal justice system. So very excited about it. But the system is very slow. There are 28 KPIs that have been agreed upon throughout the value system, which will provide all managers throughout the value system with that management information on those 28 KPIs, which have been agreed on and signed off between the various components. But obviously there are a lot of teething problems. It is a complicated system. The biggest problem is standards, specifically within the Department of Justice environment, and I understand that that's due for an upgrade, and with that happening, that will really make sure that the system can go up quicker. So the planned activities are, as I said, 22, but Benoni and Davidson are the two that are piloting for us, and 170 sites are planned for the current financial year, 2015-16, and 481 sites currently exist and will be completed as the program. So there's a magistrate's court. Every magistrate's court should have that capacity and that capability, and will really ease up a lot of the administrative burden that we currently have on prosecutors and also the police and all other role players in terms of providing statistical, as we call it, information, performance information. So we're very excited about this and hope that we can see this delivering. On ICT infrastructure, just to give you some background, a lot of our technology was reaching end of life, so video conferencing equipment, you know, with the cost-saving measures, one wants to see how one can utilize modern technology to reduce travel, and, you know, travel is not only cost, but also a human capacity cost, just the persons on the road where you could be productive, etc. Also, our telephone service was very outdated. All prosecutors did not have computers, and printers were outdated, etc. And as you said, the biggest problem was also the bandwidth that was constantly utilized, about 100% utilization, and a lot of resulting in time out, etc. It's gone the wrong way. So what we've done, and I'll tell you which has been paid for and which has already been taken completed. So the upgrading of the video conferencing is complete, except for the Joburg, Pretoria and Toyando office due to the building renovations. In Joburg, we're moving to inner chambers, and the Pretoria office is looking at the demarcation, and Toyando is also an upgrading process that's ongoing. This is fully being paid for. Everything's been delivered. It's just the installation that has to happen. Network switches that have reached end of life are being replaced. This has also been paid for, so we're better to pay in the new financial year. It was paid in the previous one. Computers, laptops, and printers for prosecutors, they've been procured, paid for. Most of it's been paid from the last financial year. It's a very little bit that might be paid in the current financial year. And we're currently rolling this out through the Department of Justice to all our prosecutors throughout the country. The network bandwidth is being upgraded, partially paid for. There's still a portion that needs to pay for, but the bulk of this is also being paid already. And our upgrading of our telephony system at all our offices has been paid for. It's just a rollout and installation thereof. So the bulk, these are very expensive items. And because we knew that the budget cuts were coming, we utilized our budget in the financial year in which we had the money so that we could make sure that we would plan effectively and to comply with government's call for us to do more with lessons and not ask for money than there isn't money. Ethics management remains a critical component for us, and we've adopted a zero-tolerant approach to fraud and corruption within our organization. We had a fraud and corruption prevention plan which monitored the implementation thereof, And in the past financial year, 2014-15, there were three prosecutors that were convicted for offences relating to corruption. So we keep a record of that. We also look at the labour relations, in fact. And they were, two of them were dealt with in our labour relations. One person resigned before we finalised the labour relations, but the criminal case is proceeding. And the other one was taken to implement progressive discipline as a result of the reluctant witnesses and lack of cooperation from the supervisor. So this is relating to the labour relations. But as I said, the criminal prosecution does continue. We also have ethics promotion officers, and we engage with the residuals. So we've got a very successful program at the moment that's running called Coffee Shop Ethics Forum, which is done once a month on a Friday afternoon for 2 hours, where we discuss ethical issues over a cup of coffee. Seriously. And it is actually yielding remarkable results, because prosecutors specifically don't always have an opportunity or a place to talk about the challenges that they are faced with on a daily basis. And to this engagement, your peers discuss how do they deal with these situations. You know, with the latest approach to zero policy to accepting any gifts, that's also a huge discussion. I mean, what a cup of coffee is a person, you know, except for those kind of things. So it's very, very productive, and it has yielded great results. Coffee Shop Ethics Forum. Yeah. You're welcome to come to one. You'll really enjoy it. Yeah. It's not in a coffee shop. It's in our own building. Just call it that. We just give a cup of coffee, and people sit around and over a cup of coffee. We talk. Then you are equals. Like, there's no manager and no junior. It's equals. And it's really yielding excellent results, and a lot of other government departments are approaching us to talk about our results and what we're achieving. Public awareness and outreach remains a very important program. Face-to-face public education engagement with civil society, especially in the indigenous areas, is critical to us. And then we also have our flagship community television program, NPA for My Justice, which has been really very successful in increasing public awareness about prosecutions. And season 2 of this program is planned for roll-up in the current financial year.
Thank you, Chair. That brings us to the end of our presentation.
Okay. I see Advocate Mpumulang is also always laughing, but I think he's laughing in appreciation of your creativity. Because you see, at work, there is a lot of stress, and some people can cope with situations. To give them room just to talk to others. It's very good, because otherwise we have people suffering from depression and we have all these challenges. So congratulations. I'm going to try that in my office, because I see some co-workers don't even look at me. They think I'm a problem. But I think just to make one or two observations, Dr. Ramaite, when you say if it were not for poor investigations and lack of evidence, that could be seen as casting aspersions on the Department of the Police, unless it's explained, because also it would be in our interest to know what are the challenges in that area, so that we assist where we can. Mrs. Fandale, you know South Africans are very wary of secret services. So if you say that there are special projects that you can implement for local resources, one may say, what are these projects? Are they secret projects? Because if you mention them, maybe those who hold the purse may be sympathetic to you, because they will be able to assess for themselves whether this is an important project at all. There's also Mr. Nwasan, Advocate, where you talk about the slump in, and then, because if there's a slump and there are constraints, you don't tell us the constraints. Now, when I say, you know, that affects the success or otherwise of the prosecution, so it would be good to be a little bit transparent there. I'm interested in this recovery of costs. that you put in, you call it CARA. I run an organization called CARA, but I haven't received anything from you. But you see, it's interesting because, you know, victims of crimes, unlike in traditional courts, don't get any compensation. Now, if it's possible to recover, shouldn't that recovery be utilized to compensate victims, or is the law that doesn't allow it, or is the practice that doesn't allow it, or is there a need for alternative funding that prevents it? If you can highlight that, because that could be an area where perhaps we need to look at the law as it operates. The other area would be the question of social crimes. There are lots of social crimes, you know, the moral degeneration in the country, proliferation of taverns, bottle stores, everybody drank from Friday to Monday. So on Monday, lots of people are at the police stations being charged who don't even remember what they did and where they were. Is that situation not placing a burden on you? And if so, what do you think could be done? Because there is a debate here about community courts, about traditional courts, and don't you think that if that situation that I'm speaking out exists, whether these other initiatives couldn't be speeded up to assist you in that regard? Lastly, the electronic case management. There is this incidence of dog heads that get missing. Is this designed to deal with that situation? But now that you are still at a pilot stage, can you just give us a sense of this missing dog head? Is this really missing, or is it by design? And to what extent does this affect the levels of prosecution? Thank you. Honorable members, the floor is open. I see that Honorable Biedenbach has been waiting for too long, and I'll start with her. And then Honorable Hon, Honorable Swart, Honorable Mpumulang, Honorable Maila, Honorable Bonga.
This set of questions is directed to Mr. Kassana. There are a lot of people here today apparently who are acting. Is there some reason why you have so many acting members, and why haven't people been appointed in a permanent capacity? And the next question is also from Mr. Kassana. The matter of Inga's Lot was prosecuted here in the Western Cape some time ago. The accused was one Fred van der Vijver. He was acquitted. Can you tell me what position is with that matter and if it's still being looked at? The Minister of Justice tells me it's finalised and is regarded as finalised. I'm not sure how a murder matter can be finalised if the accused is acquitted. That means there's somebody else out there who did it. What's been done to find that person? Then, next question is for Mrs. Lensburg. The matter of occupation specific dispensation at level 10, LP 10, can you tell me what the position is there, please? I have queries on a daily basis from prosecutors all over the country. So I'm really concerned that this matter seems to be going nowhere. So if you could just help me with that, please. And also from Mrs. van Rensburg, the new High Court in Polokwane and Middelburg, I forget what the new name is, on Nelspruit. How are those courts going to be stopped? And what is the position with the Pretoria office? And people from that office, who I presume are going to either be transferred or voluntary or involuntary. And how is that meant to be dealt with, please? this last matter that you dealt with, the ECMS, this has been a program that's been running for some time, at least, probably a conservative estimate, at least 5 or 6 years, but probably longer. And it doesn't ever seem to really get off the ground. A lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of money has been put into it. And I'm really glad to hear you say that it's been piloted in some areas. But can you tell me how many case dockets have in fact been loaded onto the system successfully? How many of those loaded have in fact been used in court proceedings successfully? And how are the police and the prosecutors trying to deal with integrative information contained in that database? Because at the end of the day, that is going to be the biggest problem. Then for Mr. Hoffman, what is the current state of affairs with the Andrew Phillips matter in the ranch? What is going on in that matter? I understand it's an ongoing issue. I'm really happy to hear, and this is for Advocate Mahatla, that cybercrime is something that you're concerned about. Could you help me with how training and improvement of capacity of prosecutors and police, because they're so interconnected that you must have interest in both, even though I'm perfectly aware that the police are not your issue. How are these people being trained and capacitated to deal efficiently with the ever-changing landscape of cybercrime? And what is being done about the new legislation that's in the pipeline, particularly the COFI Act, with regards to this issue? To finish off the thing about the EGMS, the Minister of Police told us that one docket had been loaded onto the system, which seems inordinate amount of money spent for one doctor. So I'm sure that's a mistake. You could just jump in with that. Then I'm not sure who would have to deal with this. Probably Mr. Pasana. Just simply because you have an overarching capacity that covers everybody's issues. The Diwani matter, you can't possibly be satisfied with how that turned out. And can you tell me what remedial action has been taken in that regard? Because I don't think anybody is satisfied with how that turned out. Certainly the judge wasn't. I'm also interested to hear, also probably from you, unfortunately again, sorry, the matter of the KZN previous judge president, Mr. Patel. What is the position of that matter? How did that happen? And what is the position with the civil claim? I have other questions, Mr. Chair, but perhaps I don't want to monopolize all the time, so if other members don't ask them, then I'll ask them at the end. Thank you.
Not wanting to monopolize. Thank you very much. There's a practice in this committee that if there are things that you can answer, we allow you to go back, prepare, and send us a response. Because we are politicians, we are officials. And if you say something that you're not sure about, we will be tempted to say you have lied before this committee. And we don't want to do that. So don't answer things that you are not ready to answer. Because you prepared the presentation. I can see you focused correctly on the budget process because we are dealing with the budget. But we can't stop members from putting other questions. So if they put questions that you are not prepared for, simply say you can't answer the question or need to go back and respond in writing and send the response to my office. Thank you very much.
So, there's one matter I forgot that I really would like to cover. I would like to congratulate the NPA on the outcome of the Arthur Brown matter. I think that was a shocking sentence in a court of first instance, and on the appeal, I think they did really, really well, and I would love to congratulate them on that.
Audits, but I also got a sense that they hurry to finish the money. I hope it's not on parties or the coffee shop. over to you.
Thank you. Firstly, I think the Honorable President asked about why do we have many acting members? Yes. I'm sure that when I started off with my presentation and introducing the members that are here with me, I mentioned about three acting members. I'll start with the Chief Financial Officer, Mrs. Van Zee.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I'm just sensitive about the matter raised in the release to time. I want to suggest a different process, that I see all members want to ask questions. Maybe we must take all the questions so that the answer at the end, because we may have to plan questions.
So,
thank you, Chair. With respect, it might be that there's follow-up questions as to some of the answers. So I will be wholly unsatisfied, and I think we will not discharge ourselves of our duty as a committee if we only allow ultimately written answers, because I see that's the way we are working toward. Then if that is the case, then I don't think we will discharge ourselves of the duty.
With due respect, I said there's a practice that if there are matters that can be dealt with, we'll ask people to send written responses. I have not asked people to send written responses. I thought we were answering to Honorable Bonga, then you were irrelevant to the question that he answered. So I would rule that we proceed with the approach that he suggested. And the simple thing is that when you put questions, they will note down the questions, and after answering, I will also give you an opportunity to make follow-ups. So there's nothing that will prejudice you except a protracted discussion on the approach.
May I just also remind us of the process that we have where we allow two rounds of questions. Normally, like you've asked a number of questions and Ms. Breitenbach has asked a number of questions, and maybe it is a suggestion to allow an answer to those, and then we have a second round. That's also been a practice. So I'm in your hands in that regard as well, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe on the outset to just touch on what you've already said in terms of the clean audit and Breitenbach in terms of the J. Arthur Brown cut. I think we must state that as a committee, we must be generally satisfied with the achievement of targets by the NPA. And if we then focus on some of the failures, it does not necessarily indicate that we are really critical. Having said that, then the first question I want to raise is in respect of the on page 21 there, the target of 88% in respect of the conviction rate in district goals, which is lower than the achieved target in three preceding years. So I just want to get an indication as to why that target has been set lower as what has been achieved previously. It seems to be a bit counterproductive to me, Chair. Then, coming to some of the failures, there's been two cases involving minors that has been reported on recently by the media. The one was in the Free State, where the High Court found that the NPA did not deal with the matter in line with the Child Justice Act. And then there was more recently a report of a matter in the Eastern Cape where I think, well, we will not deal here with the failings of the magistrate, but where it transpired that the NPA did not insist that the charges be put to the accused. And then secondly, that it transpired that the accused was actually charged with some four charges, three of which related to repealed sections of the Sexual Offences Amendment Act. So the question is, I mean, this does not necessarily indicate a pattern, but we get back to the sensitivities surrounding sexual offences and minors. So the question is whether, and we don't get separate reports on those, and while we know that that is difficult cases to handle, I want to get an indication as to what the situation is, please. If not in respect of these specific cases, then generally. Then, Chair, in terms of page 36 of the presentation, maybe that's a question more for clarity, although I don't think I understand it wrongly. There's these targets for recovery from government officials, and as I read it, it's 100,000, 200,000, 300,000, and ultimately 400,000, unless it's 3 millions. And I know it's not been a target measured previously, but I just want to ask the question whether in terms of the perception out there of whole-scale corruption, whether the NPA feels that that's really realistic target. Unfortunately, I think in the presentation it's even been called ambitious targets, which I think I must differ with. Yes. Then, Chair, coming to maybe also those who are, in terms of the senior management, not here. It's been said that Advocate Diba is not here, but I did not recall a reason why she could not join us today. And then maybe for Mr. Kasana, it was mentioned here that there is now a zero tolerance policy towards fraud and corruption in the NPA, but she is in fact in charge with fraud. So what is the situation? And although we are appreciative of the fact that it's not within his authority to suspend her pending the outcome of those processes, in what way does he deal with the fact then that there's a criminally abused amongst his senior membership, senior management. And then,
we know that everybody is presumed innocent, found guilty. So
that might be the case. It's also not uncommon for somebody to be suspended from your normal workings if you are facing such serious indictments, and in the case of the NPA, which deals with criminal prosecution, I think that would be that would apply definitely, not maybe. Then, Chair, coming to also senior management and the levels of leadership, the question is, and Ms. Tafana may answer this, or Dr. Amahiti or Advocate Mukhatla, because there's also this issue of Mr. Nzungati and Mr. Mukwebe, who also faces applications to be struck off the roll, perjury charges, charges of defeating the ends of justice. So the question ultimately is that whilst we are, as I said, appreciative of the fact that there's process to be followed, the question is what leadership can somebody who is compromised to that extent provide in a situation where they are actually managing prosecution. Whether in their opportunity it has compromised the institution and how it is being dealt with at the moment. And then lastly, Chair, the case against Ms. Mukwebe has been struck off the roll. And whilst we are not to be to meddle with court processes, what is important for us is that the reason why it's been struck off the roll was there because there were
an application for a postponement from the NPA side to get an opinion from a senior advocate in this matter. And the magistrate said, but I cannot postpone this in order to allow you to get this opinion because you are the experts in this country regarding prosecution and the criminal law. And resultantly, as I said, it was stuck off the rail. So I think as a committee, we need an explanation as to why the NPA felt that they could not handle that independent from the opinion of somebody at the bar. Thank you.
I'm not going to suppress questions, but I also don't think we should go into Mail and Guardian debates, newspaper debates, and debates about things that are before the court. But I think we are dealing with a qualified and capable people here. They will be able to answer for themselves. So that, just want to warn that.
Yes, Chair, that's why I specifically said if they are not prepared to respond to the specific two cases I referred to, I think one of the problems is that there's no reporting on a sexual prosecution of sexual crimes in respect of minors, and it is a perception out there that it's still being dealt with and sometimes sloppily. So in general, I want to respond. I did not request of them to respond of those specific matters. In case of the Mkhwebi matter, it's been struck off well. So as a matter of fact, it's not a test before the court. And I think we as a committee must be entitled to ask as to why the NPA allowed it to be struck off.
I've made your point. I think they got the question. All I'm saying is that if they don't answer things that they may not answer, we won't hold that against them. But there are a couple of lawyers, they will deal with the situation. Let's not debate that. Honorable Sart.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for the presentation, and thank you for the good performance under difficult budgetary conditions. Chair, we need to be reminded that their targets were increased and their budget was not increased. So there's been a massive improvement, I think, and we need to acknowledge that under very difficult conditions that we are all aware of in the media. I, for my side, don't want to ask the NDPP and Kusana about the inquiry, but I want to say from my side that I'm concerned about the delay in the finalization of that issue, okay? So I'm not asking a question about that because I understand it would be difficult for him to respond to that. But
you are just asking him to be a judge in his own court.
No, Chair. I'm saying from my side we're entitled to make a comment just to say that obviously it impacts on the NPA, and I would urge the parties involved, particularly the chairperson, to try to finalise it as quickly as possible. I'm not asking a question, Chair. Secondly, the issue of xenophobia that has impacted our nation, and everyone is thinking about that, I would ask the NPA what steps they are able to take to speedily prosecute these matters. The Minister indicated the possibility of special courts, and we hope it won't be necessary because we hope it is being contained. And we see even in the Sotoli matter that the perpetrators have already been brought to court. But I would ask, what first steps is the NPA able to take? Because we know that the speed prosecution of criminals, xenophobic people involved in that, will serve as a deterrent. Yeah, the asset forfeiture unit, I was pleased to hear about the rollout of small matters at Bukit Hofmeyr. Is it intended to roll that out to other provinces? Because clearly that would also assist. And then the of great concern, and this is an issue, Chair, that I've raised in budget meetings, in budget considerations with other departments, the lack of capacity that we are giving to, and we'll raise it next week with SIU, but with Asset Forfeiture Unit. There's a win-win situation, Chair. How can it be that they'll have to turn work away due to lack of capacity? It can't be right. Because we are, if we're given capacity, they're able to collect funds. It's the same as the SIU. So, Chair, we need to look very carefully about that. It is of a great concern that they have the powers. We've given them additional legislative powers to SIU, but again, particularly the Asset Forfeiture Unit, that they have to turn away work where they can collect billions because of lack of capacity. So, Chair, that is a very serious issue that we need to deal with. Thirdly, Chair, you touched on the issue of the relationship with the SAPS, and it could be that we might need to have a discussion with the Portfolio Committee of Police, because clearly there seems to be a problem there. When we look at media reports about the service of certain subpoenas, we look at what Judge Traversa said in the Diwani matter about stopping investigation. We note that there seems to be a problem there that impacts on the MPA. How can we hold the MPA accountable for their progress when there could well be an underlying problem with the investigation? And so, Chair, I'd like them to comment on that relationship with the SAPS as well. Lastly, Chair, the issue relating to the witness protection. We receive emails from members of the public that are having their lives threatened. And I would like to know, clearly, the police investigating these matters, but what's the criteria that is used for people being placed on the witness protection? Because I have received two confidential matters already where the matter hasn't come to the MPA yet, but it's with the police, where there's been actual attempts on people's lives. And surely that, to me, cries out why, in that circumstance, are the police not referring that to the witness protection, or does it only when the docket gets to the MPA is that an issue? So I'd like some clarity as to how I advise those persons. Thank you, Shane.
I think they came to you as a member of parliament.
Yes.
You should bring that to the committee so that we can collectively look at these things.
Otherwise,
it remains a private matter.
No.
Okay.
Thank you. I want to say to basically you people have done very good work. Appreciate your work. I just wanted to point certain things which have to assist in improvement. There is not a perception exactly what is happening in particular in the rural areas. There used to be a very good relationship between the police and the MPA. The decision whether a person should be arrested or prosecuted, they discuss that, and the victim is usually not involved in that. These are serious cases of murder. I wish I could have your card so that we discuss this matter. I tell you the cases. There are quite a number of them. It's a painful thing, and this is what is happening. It is still continuing. Particularly related to people who don't have money, people in the rural areas and poor areas. And I wish, I'm sure we will bring this to your attention and you probably assist in that. I just want to let you know that they are substance. Coming to the question of prosecuting that could affect you, do you have monthly meetings with the SAP, as for example, as to say, hey people, you are delaying us? I mean, there are quite a number of cases, I think you have confessed to that, that are delayed as a result of poor cooperation with the SAPs. There are also small crimes. There are illegal gambling that is happening in small towns. Three of them. There seems to be no prosecution at all regarding that, and this affects the old people. The other one which I would wish you could check is Omatonis. It's taken some kind of a law that people more especially the elderly people. They take their cards, they take their IDs, and which there's a law against that, but there's no prohibition. Particularly in the rural areas. In so much that police don't even know that this is a crime. They are also in certain areas in the next to the sea shore where there are people who just come and fish and take the abalone and other, well, it's known in Durban in Cape Town, but in these rural towns, it's not known. Can you inform the these people to improve procedures in that regard? Of course, madam, I appreciate the question of the ECMS, and I think it will improve our work. Who pay for it? Is it in the budget of the Department of Justice? Or, I mean, it seems to be it's a part everybody has a pie. Who pays for it? I just wanted to be informed, and I'm happy that you even surrendered 12 times and 4.5 cents, 4.5 cents. So this brings me to the 4-officer unit. You're doing a very good job. I mean, don't you? Who kills the ghost that lies in dead ghost? I thought that there is some percentage that must come to LPA of the amount that you guys are collecting. And I was also asking if you, when you are predicting or projecting that there will be more and more and more, are you suggesting that we are losing the war on corruption? There will be more and more prosecution on the more money received. And are you saying we're losing the war on corruption, or is there any indication that morality? But crucial question I would like you to address, is the question of the language. There is this impression. I mean, it's very painful sometimes. You get into a foreign court in South Africa. All these people speak your language. But everything is conducted in a foreign language. You don't know what's going on. You just get an interpreter saying, now, you have been found guilty. Go. You know, and you don't have the touch. The policeman may not even know English, but he writes a statement in English. That affects your life. I would think that why don't you use the African language from the word go, the doctor, everything written in African language, because it's, are we writing for record or are we doing justice first? Are we concentrating on justice done or are we concentrating on language written? Because there are many things. I'll just give you one small example. If you say in Sikosa, they are over, it may mean four things. It may mean that I hear you. It may mean that I understand you. It may mean that I agree with you. It may mean that I disagree with you. Now, which one is the interpreter going to give? I want to believe that in many other languages, a similar thing is there. So if we are concentrating on justice being done, justice for all, it's very, very important that we see, in the olden days, we don't need to concentrate exactly what the other people care to know what's going on. You are coming to God, you told him that now... What's going on?
I'm trying to listen to the questions of Honorable Mula, but this side is noise, and I can't concentrate.
We understand, Mr. Bonga.
So they're not listening.
They are out of order.
So, you see, in this committee, we
say there must be respect and self-respect. But sometimes we must remind one another of that agreement that there must be respect and self-respect. So there shouldn't be any intolerance. No, I think you are reminded. I think we can proceed.
I think
you are protected, Honorable Boga.
Yes, I think that it is very, 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 very important in that there is an implication that at least Muhammad must go to the mountain. That's what my lecturer said to me one day. I cannot speak the language of a slave. But this one is different now. We're talking about, you look at it very seriously. It does affect a person. When you come into a foreign court, as it were, everything is in a foreign language. You don't understand a word. Secondly, you couple it with the fact that the system of procedure is foreign. In the African language, in African culture or law, if a person is said to have committed a crime, the mother is reported to the family. The family interrogates the person, have you done that or not? Says, no, if he says, I have done it, then the family comes to the other family and we apologize for what has happened and we were prepared to give compensation. That is what we normally do. And secondly, if in this system, you take a person, an individual, throw him in a van, put him in court, are you guilty or not guilty? Now, so the procedure is foreign. Now, the second foreign thing is allowed. And then, I just want to explain, because this thing happens, used to happen, and we accept it as if it is normal. And this is an oppression to majority of the people in this country. I just wanted to raise that, those particular things. Thank you. I'm sorry, take your time.
I don't know why Ms. Fonseca, I do allow a caucus. Because we don't want misrepresentation. I told the Honorable Mpumulani was not laughing at you. He was laughing in appreciation of the good work you've done. I think he has confirmed it. But, you know, what he is saying about language, yesterday in the sitting of the Justice Committee, we had a very interesting story. You know, you have a law which says that if you are married, you can't deny your partner conjugal rights. And then in the African language, they say, Ogasu Timemabai. Now, a man appears before the magistrate and says, no, I beat up this woman because Untimemabai, meaning that she denies me my conjugal rights. And the magistrate said, don't waste my time. Why don't you go and buy other blankets? You can see a miscarriage of justice because of language. And also, I don't see any reason why we should plead with you or with the courts to say use indigenous languages. I think we should just make sure, and there are many ways of doing so, to say to the universities, nobody has received a law degree unless they have one or two indigenous languages. So we won't be wasting time debating the language. We made that point with the department, and I think we need to have some meeting with the universities, with yourselves, and just indicate how language is a barrier to access to justice and deal with that and then revise the curriculum once and for all. Because what we may be having now is access to the courts and not access to justice. And that would be a big problem. But I think I still have Honorable Maila and Honorable Bonga on my list.
Thank you, Jefferson.
and thanks the NPA for your presentation, and thank you also for the way you account for how you use the discuss. The NPA's purpose and identified public perception and reputation of the NPA as a risk. And indication is that you are continuing to manage that situation. So I would like to know where we are now. How do you view the public perception about the NPA? And what exactly are you doing to ensure that if it is on a negative side, it becomes improved? There is also an issue which was raised by Honorable Horn on the conviction rate in regional courts, but also in the district courts. The previous 3 years, the audited performance is slightly high, but now your targets are a bit lower. So I'd just like to know why is that situation prevailing? Are you maybe trying to say people should work less or maybe relax? Now there is also this issue on the witness protection. Over the past 3 or 4 years, there are no indication of witnesses who are harmed, threatened, or killed while in the program. But what actually surprises me is that whilst we are able to achieve this, that witnesses are not threatened, are not harmed, are not killed, but there are those who walk away. So I just want to know the reasons why do these people walk away? Why, if we are able to protect them, can't we be able to ensure that they don't walk away from the problem? There is also the issue of conviction rates in violent protests and industrial actions. Now, I just wanted to know, because you have the issue, public awareness. Yes, that whilst we are convicting people for this protest, can this also be part of your public awareness? Because the issue of just convicting cannot equally be the solution to the problem. Chairperson, thanks very much for
Honorable Lanaila, Honorable Bonga. Yeah, thanks, Chair. And thanks for the presentation. My first one would be the issue on the vacancy rate and vis-a-vis the workload that we would then have to take in terms of the courts that are going to be built in Mpumalanga and Limpopo. And then the second one, on page 28, they're saying the number of persons convicted of corruption or offences related to corruption where an amount benefited is not more than 5 million. Then there's ANA in terms of 2012 to 13, 11, 12, and 13, 14, but in the outer year, 14, 15, there will be 20. I would want a comment on that one. And then also, Chair, a comment on the body that must be set up to review the decisions of the prosecution. Because I think we don't have the what we call complaint management mechanisms of the prosecutors. What would be their comment and their preparedness to deal with that matter? And we're quite impressed on the issue of audit outcomes and the issue of ECM. But another issue that I'll be interested in is how the plan to deal with the delay on prosecutions. And I'll also be interested, Chair, in the NPA, the breakdown of who of the employment statistics. How many are colors, how many are whites, how many are black. So
so that you can also see whether how far we in terms of the issue. It may be used interchangeably.
African colored Indians. All of them constitute black.
Okay, thank you for that. So I want just to try the issue of how we deal with the transformation in the space, because I don't have the indication on how we're dealing with the issue of transformation. I think I'll stop there for now, sir. Thank you.
Advocate Masana, I think the approach that you followed, you deal with those that you want to deal with, and then you pass on the others. Continue just.
Thank you, Chair. Question of acting appointments. The position of the chief financial officer was advertised, shortlistings have taken place, and there'll be interviews conducted very soon, and hopefully we'll find the candidate and fill post. The position of the acting deputy CEO, the deputy CEO went on retirement just recently, and the post will also be advertised. Then the position of Mr. Duma, I think just to touch on it, he's acting as my advisor in the office. That position also was advertised already, and I think the support services CEO office are busy with the shortlisting. Then another question. Unfortunately, the question that you asked, Honorable Weidenbach, about the case, the matter in Cape Town, I am not aware of that matter. I don't know if anyone can assist me with that matter. Otherwise, that's one of the matters that I'll have to go back and perhaps respond by way of writing. Ingelot's matter, yes. Then you also asked about the Diwani matter. Obviously, I think all of us are not happy about what happened. We have asked for a report from the DPP of this province. I think we received the report. It's one of the set stories where really we could only rely on the evidence before us, especially one of the persons who was allegedly involved in the matter, who became a 204, and we ultimately did not have control of him when he took the witness stand and recanted from his original statement. That's a sad story, and unfortunately there was little that we could do about the matter. But we are very much concerned about it. We've learned a lesson from what happened there, and we are discussing the matter, we discussed the matter, and with a view to trying to find ways of dealing with similar matters in the future. Judge Patel's matter, indeed, we've received, so far as reported in the media, I must say, we've received a letter of demand, and we've referred the letter of demand to the relevant unit of the office, the Legal Affairs Division. They are busy dealing with the matter, and we haven't received summons so far. Well, suffice it to say that yes, he was charged. I think the letter of demand it follows. It's a consequence of the charges that was preferred against him, which were subsequently withdrawn. The other cases that I think Honorable Lohan asked about, especially the fact that Advocate Mkhwebi's case was struck off the roll. And the report that I received was that the matter was struck off the roll after the magistrate refused a postponement. But what I was informed was that we the prosecutor didn't say that he wanted to get an opinion from counsel, but that he wanted to brief, and in fact were even requested the minister to appoint the Section 38, which he had agreed. Unfortunately, we couldn't get the postponement, but the matter, I understand, as far as I understand, it's with on, and we're looking into the matter, and we have sent the brief to the council to deal with the matter. I'm sure I'm not at liberty to, without being disrespectful to the members, to deal with the questions that you have asked, Honourable Horn, regarding the fact that senior members of the organisations are facing either criminal charges or their applications for strike off. I am not at liberty to make any comment about those matters, because I think they're in the public domain.
We are not prepared. We're going to invite him to the coffee shop.
Chair, but with all due respect, I did not ask for comment on the fact that these applications went to be struck of the roll. I asked for comment as to how the NTA is dealing with the fact that while this is in play, they are still in senior leadership positions, and we as a committee, I think, is entitled to know how the NDIA is dealing with this to ensure that the credibility and the effectiveness of the institution is not compromised. That was my question.
Thank you, then. Well, I think in answering your question, I think we have management meetings and as the head of the institution, playing a supervisory role, and I make sure that everything is going on and it's business as usual. So far, I cannot say that the facts that they are facing those charges have really prejudiced the institution. That is my view so far.
Eloquently testifies to it.
Unless there is a specific reminder of the questions that I have to answer, perhaps the issue of the just to most advocate Buluan is Mbumlwane's question. In fact, I think it was a comment. Mbumlwane. Well, I think it's my accent. I think especially whether we have meetings with the SAPS, we have forums where we meet with the SAPS. But I have to be honest that I haven't had the opportunity to meet at the highest level with the commissioner, but we do have structures where we meet with the members of the SAPS in different forums, and where we chart the way forward. But recently also we recently had a workshop, which was a workshop organized by the NBA, but with all stakeholders, including the police, where we formulated the strategy and identified, and we came up with a strategy of identifying matters at an early stage, together with the police and working together and using a model that we call a prosecutor guided investigation model, so that we identify matters, cases at a very early stage, and hope in the prosecutor who will guide the prosecution so that the matters don't fall through the cracks, and we are able to identify matters until they... And that talks also to prosecution of these matters expeditiously. Then there has to be that coordinated approach. The question of the language, I have said in different forums, and this issue seems to be a burning issue, and it has been with us for quite some time. I know also that even in the attorney's profession, they also deal with this matter also in the in the in the in the
advocate profession. It has been identified as one of the challenges also with access to justice. I know also that there was a time where I think it was piloted the, what you call it, the indigenous courts. There were indigenous courts that were set up to deal with, to use indigenous languages in court. But that project, I think it was stopped. I think it was run by the Department of Justice because they felt that it was effective. It was impractical for to be used. Indigenous languages, I think that is, if you can, if, I think the CEO can talk more about it, because I remember it was piloted in the rural areas, but it didn't work.
Just when you say the word impractical, what does impractical
mean? I think the Department of Justice and the issue representative, yes, I think Mr. Adams, can I be add a bit to the response there, because it was a project within the department. One of the big challenges was the balancing of employment equity and the need to make sure that every single office was representative of the country as a whole, with the need to have your indigenous court. So in some of the areas we were struggling with to get a court that comprised of a magistrate, an interpreter, well, the human interpreter, and a clerk of the court, the prosecutor, everybody who could speak that same language, because of the need to make sure everywhere we were equally representative. And the other problem then was, if the docket was written in indigenous language, one, and a different prosecutor had to take it over because that person was sick, who couldn't read that language, it was where the problems were coming in. But I think Mr. Adams can deal with that question more effectively, because it was a Department of Justice initiative, and they are here today represented, so I think perhaps we should ask them to respond to in more detail, because that's their area, the policy area, and that's where the department is involved in. So I think he's better placed to answer this question.
Chairperson, thank you for the opportunity. I would ask respectfully that if Chairperson could allow the department at a later stage to respond to the question, because at this stage I am unable to respond to that question. I will refer the matter to the Director General and the DDG Court Services, Mr. Malema, for that response.
You know, I also maybe think that we are putting the correct question but in a wrong context. You see, we were saying, as matters stands now, the universities produce lawyers who don't know indigenous languages. Now, to expect the prosecution and the courts to cater for these languages is actually impractical, impossible, because we don't have the right lawyers with the right knowledge. Maybe the focus should be that I think ourselves, we shouldn't be spectators, ourselves, yourselves, and the department, and the universities. We really have an endeavor to deal with language as a barrier to access to justice. And that's where you can come with a report on your pilots and so on, and say, these are the difficulties. But my view is that all that we require to make indigenous languages compulsory for law students, social workers who produce reports for the children's court, and so on and so on. So it's a simple matter, but at the moment it can be your problem. Honorable Mr. I'll come back.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. The Honorable Chair and the Honorable Members, would recall from yesterday's engagement, DG indicated that Advocates Kosana and Ms. Belay is already part of the process where the qualifications are being discussed with the Council for Higher Education, and they have made their input. The response that I am suggesting come back to the committee is the response specifically related to the Indigenous courts and not with regards to the curriculum as you've stated now, sir.
I think that we can outsource our responsibility. Lack of access to justice prejudice the majority of the people of this country. So we can't leave it to offices, these offices interacting with that office. We must take this to the public and say, how do we deal with this matter? I think that will speed up the whole thing. So maybe we should go back and say, we need this endeavor, and then we'll also communicate with the minister and the DG. Let's have an endeavor, because when we dealt with legal practice bill, we said that the law professors, law faculties will deal with it better, and it would seem that we make the realization of human rights an optional matter, and that cannot be acceptable under this constitution. So take it back, we will also take it back.
I quite appreciate Chairperson what you said. It's correct. But we cannot say that it is all the convictions they have, they're all the wrong convictions. This is what I'm talking about now. Honestly, I'm trying to express, I've been practicing this for 20 years, 25 years in the court, and I think if you, I just imagine you, everything is being conducted in Sibota, and your language is being English or French, you don't know anything. You are certainly prejudiced. And if you're saying that let there be an Ingaba, I mean, if the prosecutor cannot be found, why can't you find another prosecutor who knows the language? I mean, because strictly speaking, everything, the interpreter may not even know what's going on. May be giving a wrong interpretation and you get a wrong conviction. And that is very serious. We are talking about access to justice and fairness. And I say, unless the language is used as a person understood, and what, as I say, from the statement of the policeman, written in English, which is not what the person said, completely different. So, then, right through to the High Court, you have got a wrong, it's not the same facts, is what I'm saying.
No one would be found. All I think we are saying is that we need all the role players to come together, to be made to understand that this is a real barrier to access to justice. We need to find a solution, not piecemeal solutions, because otherwise they will have to postpone the court to look for an interpreter who may not be an accredited interpreter, and he can even mess the situation further. But otherwise, the message that we wanted to convey has been conveyed, and thank you for consistently raising that matter so sharply, Honorable Puma. Can we move on?
Thank you, Chair. There was also a question about the what does the NPA do about the cases on the attacks on foreign nationals? The NPA is engaged here with the police and the judiciary. As the members of the committee chair will know that these attacks, especially this year, started in KZN. And what KZN have done, they have approached it in a multidisciplinary approach, where the judiciary are on board. They have provided dedicated courts to deal with these matters and dedicated magistrates to deal with these matters. The prosecutor, the DDP in KZN, has appointed a senior deputy director as a coordinator, and the matters are then referred to the chief prosecutors, who are also dealing with these matters themselves, and refer the dockets to the senior public prosecutions for prosecutors for screening, only the senior public prosecutors. Therefore, once there is an arrest, the police will immediately notify the prosecutor, and the prosecutor will then be allocated a senior prosecutor and will work together with the police and guide the investigation. We are hoping that by using this approach, we will make sure that they won't be a situation where we will come back and point fingers at each other and say that the case was not properly investigated because the prosecutor is involved at the beginning of the arrest. And again, here in Gauteng,
it's a similar approach, but what in Gauteng they haven't done is to allocate dedicated courts, but they have allocated dedicated personnel in the form of magistrates and also the prosecutors. And these matters in Gauteng are held in the office of the DPP, and the DPP will allocate these matters when they arise to the state advocates and senior state advocates from his office, which is what has happened also in the case of Sithole in Alexander.
Now what I don't understand, maybe my legal knowledge is outdated. If I am a leader of an organization or leaders of an organization come together and say we are going to attack foreigners at a particular place, and then they attack them and they run away, but you have one or two of them appearing on TV saying that, yeah, we beat them up because they are taking our jobs. It means he knows the others. There's common purpose. Why don't arrest those people and touch them and then get them to reveal who are these others? Why is it that people who appear to have acted in common purpose with other people that have not been found are not prosecuted? They are even given publicity on television.
Thank you, Chair. I think with this multidisciplinary approach system that we have devised, that is exactly what is going to happen, to also identify those people who make those statements, also are given their publicity. And the prosecutors, that is why the matters have been allocated to only senior prosecutors and chief prosecutors and the advocates from the DPP's office, like in Gauteng, so that they can screen the matters and also guide the investigation. If they see that there is a need to also arrest those people, and those people will also be arrested and charged together with the actual perpetrators of those attacks. I think also the Honourable Mr. Ponga was left the house. Okay. He also asked about the board that may be set up to review the decisions of the NPA. I have had a discussion also with the members of the institute, ISS, Security Studies. They raised this issue, and it's a matter that we are still looking into. Because they also refer to us that this is a model that works very well, I think, abroad. And I think it's working in progress. We are looking into it and see whether it is possible to also use it here in South Africa. Then I think Honourable Maila asked about the walk-ups. Why can't we even, what are we doing to minimize the walk-ups? I'm sure that Advocate Mokgatla will deal with this matter, but I think it must be made very clear that when the witnesses are in the witness protection, they are left there on their own. They are not treated as the accused persons. Then if they use the program on their own, that is what we mean by walk-offs. But we try, I think this is why we have no control, so to say, if they want to leave. But in most cases, they are kept there. That is what the accommodation that they are provided. But they are really on their own. They are just advised of the benefit of staying in the witness protection program for their own benefit. I think I will pass it to Dr. Ramete.
Now you said that members should have the right to follow up. So if you don't have the answer, what do you would for that? That will take you.
Honourable Mpong, just for your benefit, the question that's raised about the possibility of the bodies that may review the decisions of the NPA. We have had a discussion with the members of the ISS who brought to attention the benefits of having this body. And they also told us about this model that is used, I think, in the UK. And what we have said is we are still considering the matter, and it's the matter that has been placed before us, and it's under consideration. Thank you.
Honorable Bonga, you must invite Honorable Braden Bachel on for tea and just have some coffee discussion.
I'll have you know, Mr. Chair, that Honorable Bonga often invites me to something considerably more than tea.
I will just ask the CEO to deal with the question.
So there were three questions raised about the ECMS, so I think I'll deal with them together. It is true that the ECMS has taken a long time to get off the ground. I think, yes, 5-6 years, maybe even a little bit longer, we've been talking about this. The main challenge was to get the various components. There's not one single minister for the various components, a different ministry and it's different departments, to agree on what the KPIs would be that we would measure by. So you have to start with the KPIs before the system could have been built. That took a number of years. So we are right now, it's infrastructure challenges. It's about getting the upgrading of the networks and getting the equipment and the space. A lot of our courts are very, very crowded, because they were built many years ago and it wasn't foreseen how big we would grow. So there's a lot of challenges in that area, all of which we're working closely together. It's not us working alone on the ECMS. It is the Department of Justice, Rectoral Services, the police, all the various role players are working together to try and come up with solutions on the different problems. In fact, such at the moment is hosting the backup system for a lot of this. The funding for the ECMS comes out of the IJS budget, of which all these various departments are part of it, but each one pays for their separate parts that needs to be developed to make it all fit together from the IJS budget, which you bid for. So it's with a very good understanding of what the money will be used for by the various departments, and a good understanding of your management needs and the kind of report that you'd like to have developed in it. The development of the system is advanced, it's finalized, and so the management reports as well. At the moment, it is piloted at 2 sites, as I said. I'm not sure, and I don't want to comment on the Minister of Police, but my information that I've received right now of my staff are at the site in Brony. In Davidson, we've got 100 active pockets, active cases. So, you know, this comes and goes because as the case is finalized, no longer active on the system. So this is right now, there's 100 cases in Davidson, dockets that are active on the system, and in Benoni there are 60 that are active on the system. Obviously, this is not all the cases because it's been piloted, but it's certainly more than the one, and I think perhaps it was just an oversight in that regard. The system is designed in such a way that it deals with docket security as well, because the whole docket is scanned at the police station. And if a docket is lost, only the hard copies are lost. You still have the soft copies that goes on the system. Data integrity is protected in such a way that if you don't have the user rights at that point, you cannot add or detract from the system. And if you do add or change anything, that is recorded and there are exception reports that get printed. So we would know then if somebody changed the status and who changed it and when he changed it, so we could easily track that person and go back. So yes, data integrity was very, very important to us as prosecutors. And that's one of the reasons why the system has taken so long, because all these little things have to be properly addressed. The development of the charges, that alone, and the agreement, because as you know, classification between prosecution and police differs greatly in terms of how you report. That alone took more than a year to agree on how that classification would go. And I think it's an important thing that has to be done, because you have to build consensus. You have to get all the role players to feel that the interests are heard, that the system will deliver to each of their needs. So we've overcome all of those hurdles. We're now at the stage where the police are actually ready to roll out far more fast than we are ready to receive at this stage. So it is at the advanced stage. There's a lot of growing pains, as they say, but with positive attitude and continued intervention, we are hopeful that this system is going to make everybody's lives a lot better, and we'll keep you posted on how we move forward with that. The next question that was for me was relating to the study of the LP10. It's definitely not true that there's no movement in respect of the LP10. On the LP10, we want to implement the LP10 specifically to address the question of individuals at level 13, which are at sometimes earning less than the other individuals at LP9 due to how we've seen the implementation of and the difference between S&S levels where you can get your notches, you can get only one, whereas if you're an LP9 and you score a score above 130, you can score 140, you can get two notches. So that makes them jump further. We brought a proposal to the NDPP, which he approved, to implement LP10 in the organization, and we have brought that proposal to the national directors. In fact, we had a meeting with the directors of public prosecution this week, and we will have a meeting the week after next with all the special directors and the DNDPP as well to discuss the nitty-gritty of the implementation thereof. The fact of the matter is that the organization cannot retrospectively implement. We simply do not have funding for that, and because of the cost implication, and we'll be going to be meeting the unions in that regard also to look at the negotiation. Obviously, funding is a very important aspect in our decision around how many posts we will create for the LP10. As you know, in the OSD, there are certain criteria that must be met, etc. So once we have that understanding, we can determine how many posts of LP10 can be created for funding capacity of the organization. The new high courts, the court in Bulawayo and Mpumalanga, those two courts, I visited the court in Limpopo myself. The building will be ready for a stagging on the 15th of May, and another 2 weeks for that to be completed, and then we can start with occupation. The recruitment of the staff is complete. The posts were advertised. All individuals were able to apply for those posts, and the recruitment is complete. But for Mpumalanga, we have procured a capacity or accommodation for our staff. While the court is finalized, next year, June, we hope that court will be finalized, but in the meantime, full capacity has been recruited and will be accommodated then. The reality of the matter is that the Pretoria office will be losing a lot of its workload due to the fact that these courts previously did not sit on a full-time basis and were serviced by people from the Pretoria office. Many of the Pretoria people did not apply for the post. And so people from other areas applied for the post and have been either promoted or people have been appointed. So the impact of the rationalization is that we are sitting with an overcapacity in terms of the demand for services at the Pretoria DPP office. We have negotiated with the unions. We have established a committee that's fully representative of the various unions, as well as the staff at the DPP office in Pretoria, Joburg, as well as Toronto, because Toronto is also affected, because the main seats will now be in Polokwane, where previously they were sitting at Toyango only. And the process that has been agreed upon, terms of reference were approved last week or being signed off. The committee will be making recommendations to both myself and the national director in terms of how we deal with requests for transfers. We've had many. We have 20 posts within the organization, all places where people can be accommodated. So we are confident that there will be no loss of jobs in this process, but that people will have to be redeployed in terms of demarcation and the act to where their work is. And we are doing that through a process with the committee, as I said, represented by the unions, and two DPPs also on this, Mr. Advocate Mnuyati, as well as Chalke, as well as the DNDPP, Dr. Ramaiti, all are on there, and my deputy CEO is also there. So it's a comprehensive committee who will look at all the requests, develop criteria, and they will then recommend to us how we take matters forward. And we are communicating with staff regularly about the process. We have a newsletter that goes out to all the staff. I see some of us raised advice about that, but that is the fact. We do, I communicate. Thank you very much for that. Well, perhaps, I don't know where you get your information from, but we actually in the NPA can give you the proof of our communications. We just met last week, so Makete is preparing my next communication to stop to tell them what the next process is in respect of that. She's as a chief. She's also on the committee. Let's just see if there was anything else. Okay, in terms of employment equity, and that's the last one I think I have to deal with. In terms of employment equity, the question was asked how we're doing in terms of that. As on the 31st of March this year, we, in terms of our total NPA staff, 51% were women, and the rest were men. Then in terms of... Too few. If you want to get things done, I've that much got at least 70% women. But thank you, Chairperson. But just to give you a breakdown, in terms of that, the total stats in terms of being African pilot, Indian and white, we were doing very well in the low levels, but we still had challenge in senior management and top management, both in terms of our women representatives as well as in terms of, you know, the black group, so to speak. But I can just give you the total percentages. Females, African females, are 13% of our staff. Colored females are 6% of our staff. Indian females 3.7 and white females 11.2. That's not too bad, more or less in terms of the staff. Yeah, we would like to see them. Too few women, 51% only. And then males, we've got 34.5% are African. 4.4% are colored, 1.7 are Indian, and 8.4 are white. So, but we are, as I say, we do. But as I said, the challenge will remain at top management, but it's a high priority. We have an employment equity strategy which we close monitor, and all our recruitment can only be done in line with our target that we've set for ourselves. Top
management. Honorable Britain, you must address the committee and speak to the record. Otherwise, oh, I see. No, but he has since repented. Can you repent? Yeah, he has repented. Okay. It shows you are very satisfied with the report and the responses. And there will be no second bite.
Okay. Thank you. There was a question regarding how we manage public perception, because it's one of the top risks in organizations. And I just must emphasize that there are two approaches that we actually link together. The one is that obviously the media plays a lot of a big role in actually sending out messages about what's happening in the organization, about the organization. So as far as that happens, we do have a media monitoring process on a daily basis where we actually understand what's being said. And we have a response plan that talks to that. So on a daily basis, if there's anything that needs attention, there's inaccurate information published in the papers, there's negative information, any of those sorts of things, we actually do have a response plan to deal with that. But on a level where we actually have to look at it at a strategic point of view, we do have our communication strategy actually talks about it, identifies perception drivers. Our focus is on the various perception drivers. For instance, like leadership is a perception driver. So any time there's anything happening around leadership, that's an issue that we would have to try and communicate around, and so on and so on. But we find that the biggest perception driver that helps the perception of the organization is performance. Performance of the organization and the services that we actually provide. And as far as that's concerned, we actually focus our resources, our energies, our investment on actually using unmediated platforms. So we do a lot of public education. We actually go to community outreach. We do community outreach. We go directly to communities with the DPPs, with the senior prosecutors, as we talk to those.
And maybe we should simply say that members of parliament should help you manage the perceptions by not adding or acting on perceptions themselves, because when it comes from us, it actually creates a very bad impression within the public, and we shouldn't do that. Thank you. Any other thing? I think we are very satisfied.
Honourable Braden,
I meant we've done the what you've had so far with this.
I'm going to be answering questions that are related to that program that I deal with. I will start with the witness protection entry. That two stages to it. There is firstly the temporary entry into the witness protection program, and Section 7 of the Witness Protection Act talks about how you can apply for that. But then if you look at the Act, it will talk about a witness. But then our definition of a witness can be a witness that is already existing, or a potential witness, or if you feel that the information that you have is going to be required and your life is threatened and you can't talk at the moment, you can go to various places. You can go to the director of the witness protection. You can go to the prosecutor that is in charge of the matter. You can go to the DPP office, and they will relay you to the direct and relevant person. You can go to the investigative officer, who will then facilitate your entry into the program. The turnaround time for entering into the program, we try to do that within 2 hours that you are placed in the position of safety. You are placed in a temporary protection for 2 weeks, wherein during that time, that's where the prosecutor, the investigation officer, assessing your case and whether or not you're the right person to be within the witness protection area. After 2 weeks, if you are going to be accepted into a permanent program, then you as a potential witness or a witness, you are going to sign an agreement form. And in that agreement form, there are various items that you have to agree to getting into the program. Coming to walk-offs. Walk-offs happen sometimes because you're just tired, you've been too long into the program, the case is not proceeding. We try by all means to make sure that the witnesses that are in the witness protection, that the cases that they are going to be testifying in are fast-tracked without necessarily taking away from the other cases as well, because you know they all have priority. But we try and prioritize those where we have witnesses that are under the witness protection, because we understand that people sometimes do get tired to be into the witness protection, because we displace them, we keep them away from their homes, and they're not necessarily on their own, as the NDPP has said. It's just that they're not forced to be into the witness protection. They still have their own free will. If they feel they're tired, we don't have control over that, then they can leave the program. Some of them leave after signing the document that I'm now leaving the program, I indemnify you and all of that. Others just walk out, you know, in the night, or don't know where they have gone to. And again, it's the frustration for sometimes the cases that are taking too long to finalize. The targets, the person who asked the question is not here. But on output 3, where the benefit is 5 million and above, the question was asked as to why do we have a target of 20. I should mention that that is a cumulative target. It's over a period of 5 years, so we have chunked it in that fashion. The question from Honorable Paytumba. The NPA, actually, let me go back to the NDPP and say the NDPP have appointed a 24/7 nodal point for that cyber program. And out of that, we have relations that are very solid with a global project on cybercrime, which is the GLASI project, funded by the European Council. And training has happened. It is happening. Just yesterday, we finalized one of the programs where we had 20 participants from various DPP offices, SCCU prosecutors, and the coordinators of the mutual legal assistance within the DPP's offices. In the near future, there's a rollout that is going to happen also from that European kind of funding, where we're going to have the investigators coming from the SAPS trained together with the prosecutors. They have already been trained the SAPS basic, the basic training has already been given to the SAPS investigators. In the near future, the next month in May, we are going to have another training which is going to happen in Namibia. It's also on cyber, funded by the U.S. Department of Justice. and MPA has already been invited to come in and participate in that program. It's fully funded. Out of the workshop that we had in the past 2 days, the GLASS project, the prosecutors that have attended the program have been identified as additional 24/7 load points for cyber-related offences in South Africa. Thank you.
Yes, I think there were three questions to me, and I think I can deal with them fairly quickly. The one question was asking what happened in relation to the Ranch case. I think the member knows that the prosecution was lost there on appeal some time ago. The AFU has been trying to return the assets. Mr. Phillips at this stage refuses to have his assets back until a large amount of money is spent on them. We're currently in litigation. We've applied to both essentially to try and get the assets back. And we hope that matter can be expedited. Mr. Swart asked us about smaller matters and turning away work. I said we are starting to have to turn away work. So it's not a significant issue, but given the amount of big cases we are getting now, we are not taking on some of the smaller matters. So it's not that we are turning away cases worth billions or hundreds of millions. All of those cases we do try and take on where they are there. But in some cases it does mean that some of the smaller cases get less priority or sometimes don't get done. Your second question was whether the NPA does get some of the amounts of the money that is recovered. You may know that the money goes to the criminal assets recovery account. Treasury has indicated in the past that they see some of the expenses that we incur as AFU almost as the first call for money in the account. We have received quite a lot over the years, but it also has been for bigger projects, both at the Anti-Corruption Task Team and in the NPA, as well as other law enforcement projects. So I think the limitation there is that money cannot be used to employ people, basically, because it has to be treated as one sort of funding rather than the current funding, which you need to employ personnel. Thank you, sir.
Finance Committee. The Finance Committee, monies that were recovered through the competition tribunals in their fines initially went to the fiscus until the Minister of Economic Development insisted that the money now goes to the competition tribunal to assist them. So when you've got parties like the SIU and Asset Forfeiture that are collecting funds and they are struggling with their capacity, the money they collect goes into the central fiscus. An argument can be made to allow more money to go through CARA to those accounts because there's already a precedent that has been created with other departments. So it's something we can bear in mind. It's nothing we can decide on now, but it is something to bear in mind if the situation continues. Again, I'm grateful for the clarification that big matters are not being turned away at the moment. It's more smaller matters. But win-win situation here. The more capacity you give, the more money is collected. So it's something to bear in mind. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Sir, for making that point more eloquently than I did. I think we need to follow up on that. I want to suggest that personally I'm very satisfied with all the answers, but if there's anyone who is less satisfied, can you communicate that to my office in writing? We'll communicate with the office of the NDGP so that they can answer, but I think that they've done very well. Honourable Horn?
Mr. Chair, is that your way of indicating that those questions have not been answered or then be answered in writing?
Yes.
Okay. And then secondly, will there now be a round of follow-ups?
No.
Why not?
you know. I know that all political parties in this house are very reasonable and they are mindful of the situation that is outside, and other members have been deployed to help put out the fires, and that's why they are not here. The matters are not closed. You can still communicate with my office. I'll communicate. But thank you very much for your very incisive questions and contributions.
I want to ask Mr. Hoffman very quickly.
Okay. No, I will allow you.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
The Fossil matter, Mr. Hoffman, as you know, is an issue that has been dragging on for years. And I'm not sure if you're the correct person to ask, because it was when you were with FIU and you're no longer there.
Walking out from that question.
That's fine. Mr. Sargent wants to spread the love. But maybe Mr. Sargent can also invite him back on. The matter is really, really old. It's been with the FCCU in Pretoria for something like 7 years now. When is this matter going to court? What is the problem? Thank you.
If she gets one follow-up, I must also. Yeah. Chair, I want to come back to my question on the integrity of the institution given the current process. And whilst you rightly pointed out that we can't expect of the national director to be the judge and the jury in his own case, I want to ask whether the management has appraised the risks involved in all of the whole goings on in respect of if there is ultimately, not only in respect of himself, but also in terms of some of his deputies, a finding about fitness to hold office, which is an adverse finding. Because in my mind, then there will be a risk of whole scale, possibly, or isolated in terms of very high profile cases, review applications. We've seen in other matters already the way the decision to prosecute or not to prosecute can ultimately themselves end up in court. So my question is whether there is a system in place currently to have checks and balances in place to prevent the institution ultimately to be subjected to wholesale review applications in terms of decisions to prosecute by not only the national director but some of his deputies if inquiries does not go in their favor. Thank you.
If anybody decides to investigate whether or not I'm a fit and proper person to chair this committee, that does not amount to a finding, and therefore it has no effect on anything. I'll continue to chair.
Chair, in fact, the issue decision of the Supreme Court of Appeal in respect of the former National Director of Public Prosecutions, Mr. Simelane, to the effect that a finding that is not a fit and proper person does not, in fact, affect any decisions made under his charge.
Thank you for being up to date. So I think Honorable Horn is satisfied. He will go home in peace.
You see, it may allow my questions, even if you're afraid of the answers.
Well, fine. This is a democratic committee and country, so we will allow all reasonable and fair questions. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned, and you are welcome to go and enjoy your weekend. I failed to reach the mayor of Cape Town to ask her to give you the freedom of the city. I think you deserve it. Thank you.